Let's begin with a very famous painting and a problem. Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night was made in early June 1889, within weeks of his arrival at the asylum at Saint-Rémy. Painted from memory, the canvas went against the grain, its astronomical configurations invented, its village motif essentially generic, its tumbling horizon lifted from other canvases. Experimental and atypical it may have been, but Van Gogh nevertheless had set himself the task not only of painting the night sky, but imagining it in dynamic relationship with the landscape. For Starry Night is a great painting of energy, from the cosmic movements of the planets above to the pulsing upreach of the cypress trees. All this is set within the strange geology of the Alpial hills and beneath vast billowing currents, perhaps suggesting the Mistral winds or the rhythms of astral bodies. This remarkable painting was made by a man cut off in an asylum, in touch with his brother Theo and occasionally other artists only by post. Was it a solitary freak of imagination, or does it belong within some broader context? Coincidentally, in Paris at the same time, Albert Besnard was working on a new commission. Besnard was a successful artist who by the late 1880s was pioneering new kinds of public decoration. He had been commissioned to paint a ceiling for the reconstructed Hôtel de Ville. The subject was Truth Leading the Sciences, an allegory apparently quite different from the landscape Starry Night. However, the original concept Besnard proposed in 1889 envisaged the city of Paris below, illuminated by a scientific allegory above. Simultaneously, yet independently, two artists, one unknown and painting for himself in a Provençal asylum, the other reputed and working on a public decoration in Paris, were trying to find ways to paint the superhuman energies of nature and to find modern styles for doing so. My problem is how to make sense of this coincidence. In this lecture, I want to explore the painting of energies. This is a way of inquiring how certain kinds of naturalism adapted themselves to address new understandings of the world, and how painting attempted to keep pace with science. It also leads one to ask if, in this wider context, there are links or consistencies between the public work of an artist like Besnard and the private art of a Van Gogh. But before we look at some unfamiliar pictures, it's essential to adumbrate the close relations between the Third Republic and science. We have seen how after 1880 the Third Republic swung into reformist mode. Social reforms, such as the lifting of censorship or the liberalisation of divorce, were matched by the promotion of mass education and an emphasis on science and technology. By such initiatives, the Republic sought to seize the initiative from conservative opponents, such as the Catholic Church, by manifesting its progressive credentials, a forward-looking ideology which would energise France. The Republic's commitment to scientific modernity coincided with a dynamic period in French scientific research, which politicians supported and used, actively trying to harness the benefits of science for the public good. Louis Pasteur, seen here in Albert Edelfelt's 1885 portrait, had been working on germ theory and microorganisms since 1857. By the 1880s, Pasteur had brought bacteriology to the scientific centre stage, and by 1900, the germs causing major social diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and tuberculosis had been identified. Leading scientists took up government posts. Paul Bert, professor of physiology at the Sorbonne, became Minister of Public Instruction in Gambetta's brief ministry of 1881-2, putting hygiene on the lycée curriculum. The great organic chemist Marcelin Berthelot became Inspector General of Public Instruction in 1885. If these were scientists who worked on a microscopic scale, Others, particularly astronomers, worked on an almost unimaginably vast scales of distance and time. Astronomy was a rapidly developing science. In 1870, less than 100 minor planets were known, a number that had tripled by 1890. France built new observatories in Meudon, Bordeaux, Lyon and Besançon in the 1870s, and in 1881 opened a museum of astronomy at the Paris Observatoire to meet public interest. Indeed, this period was one in which publications popularising scientific innovation burgeoned to satisfy the mass interest in science. But this scientific momentum was also changing the character of science. Whether scientists studied bacteria through a microscope or galaxies through a telescope, they were increasingly aware that the world and the universe in which we live was in constant flux. Old notions that mankind was somehow superior to and separate from other parts of creation, or that species were immutable, were no longer tenable. This gradual but growing realization threatened the determinism on which naturalism was founded. For example, Hippolyte Taine's notion, minted in the 1860s, that the identity of art could be determined by race, moment et milieu, began to look too regulatory. Modern French culture was encouraged to put its faith in science. If science was changing, how might this affect art? The dominant aesthetic of naturalism was founded on scientific ideas. If those were shifting to embrace concepts of flux rather than determinism, how could naturalism adapt to absorb these new notions and maintain its engagement with scientific modernity? To begin with, I want to consider a certain current in public art. It might broadly be defined as Rubensian neo-Baroque. Appropriately enough, given that this lecture is about flux and the organic, it's not a style that I would consider fixed. But what it gave in impact and credibility was indeed its mutability. This Rubensian neo-Baroque was an answer to the requirement of public art to articulate social and ideological energy. It was an emphatically modern alternative to the conventional classicism of both the murals of Puvis de Chavannes, such as the Sacred Grove of 1884-6, or sculpture like the Maurice Brothers' Republic, unveiled in the Place de la République in Paris in 1883. It also, one might hazard, offered a means for naturalism to extend itself into new stylistic territory. I will deal with it by looking at two painters, Alfred Rolle and Albert Besnard. Born in 1846, Rolle was drawn to the Rubensian. In the early 1870s, he travelled to Belgium to study Rubens, and a painting like Silenus, shown at the Salon of 1879, demonstrates Rolle's proclivity for turbulent compositions and sensual extravagance. Rolle staked a claim as an accredited Republican artist, painting a sequence of very large-scale, multi-figure compositions throughout the 1880s and 90s. The 14th of July, 1880, shown at the Salon of 1882, was followed by Labour in 1885, the celebration of the centenary of the Estates General, 1889, in 1893, and, exciting picture, the posing of the first stone of the Alexandre III Bridge, in 1899. The 14th of July set the tone, with its emphasis on the milling crowd in the foreground, through the centre of which one can make out the more ordered march past of the soldiery. The bandstand and scaffolding allowed Rolle to draw attention to the Maurice's Statue of the Republic, for this is necessarily an overtly Republican image, the tricolour fluttering above, matching the liberté, égalité and fraternité of the various classes, cheering, saluting, peddling, and indeed, one must say, on the far left, groping in the crowd below. Rolle included himself and his wife, seen from behind to centre right. At the Salon of 1885, Rolle showed a huge canvas of men at work. It's about four times the size of that. Labour. It presented a quite different concept of composition and human energy to the 14th of July. On the one hand, labour deals with specifics. It represents the construction of a weir at Suresnes in the western suburbs of Paris. Rolle made a large number of drawings of workmen at their particular tasks, using these for the figures dressing stones, shifting piles, or sawing timber. On the other, the painting has a generic character. The title, Labour, Travail, was a civic value vaunted by the Republic. It is seen as collective, the skills and muscle of the workers bringing to completion a project of public benefit. It is also egalitarian, for no worker is more important than another, not even the top-hatted supervisor in the middle distance, or Rolle himself looking in from the left, the naturalist painter as honest a toiler as the navvy. Writing in the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, André Michel praised Rolle's close observation of specifics, but worried about what he saw as the dispersion of figures and groups. To my eye, this was a deliberate strategy on Rolle's part. Lack of central focus meant lack of hierarchy. Dispersion of groups meant the eye looked here and then there, which was at once naturalistic — one cannot take in such a complex scene at a single glance — and ideological. Every labourer's task is of value. Lack of composition was thus doubly republican, in its actuality and in its egalitarianism. It was also modern, because it asserted the value of collective activity, the energy and flow of which will produce positive results. Reverting to his instinctual Rubensianism, Rolle further developed this kind of freewheeling composition a decade later in another huge painting, but of a very different subject for a different purpose. The Joys of Life, Women, Flowers, Music — I'm not making a joke about that, it's actually true — was commissioned as a decoration for one of the grand reception rooms in the Paris Hôtel de Ville and exhibited at the 1895 Salon de la Nationale. Trained to do so, one's eye looks to the centre of the composition, and in The Joys of Life finds just a void. Thus diffused to the margins, it sees dancers to the left, lovers to the right, with musicians playing and naked women frolicking in the flowers in the lower spaces. Actually, they look like roses. I think frolicking naked near a rose bush is ill-advised. The painting is broadly and naturalistically painted, with life-sized figures, but there is no narrative, let alone plausibility, to it. But The Joys of Life is not intended to be descriptive. It chaotically inventories delights: bodies, sunshine, music, play. The Joys of Life is no conventional allegory of the senses, although sight, sound, smell and touch are all to the fore, but a thoroughly modern celebration of physical and experiential well-being. The painting's incongruities confused some in 1895. Georges Lafenestre, writing in the conservative Revue des Deux Mondes, found the bricolage difficult, but he recognised, as did a completely different writer, the nabby painter Félix Valaton, that Rolle's painting was about health and energy. Roger Marx agreed, invoking the Rubensian by comparing Rolle to Jacob Jourdain's, and another Republican functionary, Léonce Bénédict, later called The Joys of Life a sort of vast naturalist and pantheist symphony. In this painting, Rolle attempted something distinctly experimental. Using his descriptive skills and bringing into play the rich Rubensian carnality that appealed to him, Rolle discarded most of the rules of pictorial composition. la composition, mais ça n'existe pas, he was to tell a younger painter a few years later. By choosing to distribute his figures, incongruous in their various activities, across the loosest of armatures, Rolle denied a single legible subject, the better to evoke the sensual effect of a whole variety of experiences, all positive and gratifying, a flow of energy, and pleasure in life. Let us now turn to Albert Besnard. Born in 1849, winner of the prestigious Prix de Rome in 1874, Besnard had the full academic training that Rolle had not. Returning from Rome, Besnard went not to Paris, but to London, where he spent the late 1870s and early 80s. There, he too was much struck by Rubens. This can be seen in one of the first mural decorations Besnard completed on settling in Paris in 1883. His three paintings, made in 1886-7 for the town hall of the Premier Arrondissement, take the three seasons of spring, summer and winter as three stages of life. The central summer, of which I show the installation and the oil sketch, represents a family at harvest time, the husband vigorously loading a powerful horse, the mother breastfeeding the smallest of their several children. This is an image of the fundamental unit of society, of healthy bodies and fecund loins, succoured by a fertile nature, rich crops and invigorating sunshine, a republican idyll, as the tricolour of their clothing reminds us. That muscular, sap-filled energy, once again, typifies the Rubensian neo-baroque. But even more than Rolle, Besnard was prepared to diversify his style. Between 1884 and 1888, he produced nine decorations for the entrance hall of the École de Pharmacie. The first group of paintings, such as The Sick Woman, exhibited at the Salon of 1884, deals with illness and its treatment with medicines. The Sick Woman is particularly dramatic, using Besnard's draftsmanly skills with foreshortening to give a narrative urgency to a design which effectively animates the rather intractable space. Four later paintings, made between 1886 and 8, depict different kinds of university instruction, two each of botanical and geological fieldwork, and another two of, dread subject, professors giving lectures on physiology and chemistry. All these are quite typical descriptive pictures, satisfying the demand for the document. Indeed, the composition of the 1888 chemistry course, with its view over and through the audience to the lecturer, appropriates a composition developed by Degas and others a decade earlier for prompting the spectator's sense of physical participation in the picture. But Besnard's work at the École de Pharmacie began to take naturalism into other areas. Seven smaller panels took on subjects such as the formation of the earth, the appearance of plants, and primitive man. Representing what Besnard could not have actually seen, such as primitive man, such objects called for invention. Their overriding theme was, of course, evolution, and the artist was thus required to use the descriptive capacities of pictorial naturalism to represent the past realities which the natural sciences were uncovering. Together, the École de Pharmacie decorations visualise the practice of medicine and the science taught in the modern university as emerging from the longue durée of evolution and the gradual development of scientific knowledge. Here was art closely geared to modern ideas. Besnard's embrace of the scientific took a further step in his next major commission. This was the ceiling for one of the three rooms in the Salon des Arcades in the Paris Hôtel de Ville. The subject, as we've seen before, truth leading the sciences behind her spreads light over mankind. The completed ceiling was exhibited in 1891. The composition was radical in several respects. Conventionally, ceiling paintings suggest great space by the upward momentum of the figures. Besnard did not deny distant space, and here it's not just the artifice of pictorial space, but the infinite space of the universe, the space being discovered by science. Truth is representing not rising, but rushing downwards towards us. This is visually arresting and also significant. We, like the men in the ceiling, receive the benefits of science and are enlightened. Such a notion accorded with Republican ideology. Benar pitched this in modern scientific terms. At the top of the composition, astronomy, as we've seen, a burgeoning discipline, points to the planets, depicted in detail derived from photographs taken through telescopes. In formal terms, Benar's truth leading the sciences is sharply coloured, causing the Hôtel de Ville's architect, Formiger, to complain about the undescriptive chromatics. It's also unusual in design, with its dynamic and brightly coloured main figure followed by a sequence of more muted, repetitive subsidiaries. Such a pictorial solution seems to me to owe to the poster designs of Jules Chéret. Chéret was in fact a friend of Benar, who drew a portrait of him in 1888, the two travelling together to Spain in 1891, the very year Benar completed his ceiling. A poster like Le Pays des Fées of 1889 typifies Chéret's angular drawing, striking use of yellows, blues and oranges, and echoing figures in repetitious momentum. Benar may well have intended this to be recognised as a means of linking his modern allegory to popular forms of representation. The whole package of truth leading the sciences, poster-like chromatics and composition, scientific knowledge and its dissemination, republican progressiveness, made the ceiling emphatically modern. Critics duly responded to it in terms of scientific modernity. For Gustave Geoffroy, all this infinitely large makes one think very logically of the infinitely small, of a drop of water seen through a microscope. The symbolist writer Georges Rodenbach praised how everything is treated in a scientific spirit. The groups circle like planets. One might call it a firmament of faces. Such reactions show how aware informed contemporaries were of the new scientific understanding of constant flux and the harmonies between the macrocosm and the microcosm. Benar's next decorative scheme was for the Sorbonne, and here form followed scientific subject even more closely. Painted for the Chemistry Lecture Theatre, Life Reborn from Death attempted to summarise the theory of transformism, the continuum of being and the unity of all matter. Life Reborn from Death centres on the sun, whose very visible yellow rays transmit generative energy to the earth below. In the middle at the top, up here, not all that easy to see, is the green putrefying corpse of a mother, spewing forth yellow flowers, while the baby which still clings to her is painted in the same brown tones as the mother's hair. This central image thus playing directly, if gruesomely, to the theme of the cyclical and regenerative continuities of chemical reactions. To the right, in the rich green foliage, I think you can just make it out, Adam lifts Eve to pick fruit, another image of continuity and nutrition. To the left, all is flux, from the rising column of brown gases to the lava-like river in deep petrol blue and orange, from which figures seem to emerge. Above all, Life Reborn from Death is a painting about flux, the cycle of growth and decay, the flow of liquids and gases, the burgeoning of vegetation, and the eternal life-giving energy of the sun. From the painting's exhibition at the Salon de la Nationale of 1896, critics recognised this. But it was Camille Mauclair, writing in 1900, who most closely acknowledged how Benar had adapted style to convey scientific ideas. Mauclair described how the acidic and metallic colours, green and sulphurous yellow, evoked chemicals, and the swirling flowers and butterflies in the sunlight, the fecund energy of natural cycles. Benar himself was proud of Life Reborn from Death, but feared that it might not be comprehensible, a fear that you probably accept. Indeed, for 1896, the decoration was a highly daring essay in pictorial organicism, a pulsing, amorphous composition which seems to prefigure the biomorphism of the Surrealists by several decades. But Baynard was surely right to be anxious in his endeavours to find new pictorial solutions to match new scientific thinking. Life reborn from death had pushed a long way beyond the legible imagery both state and public preferred. Where has this analysis of Hall and Baynard taken us? First, their allegiance to the Rubensian, sporadic though it may have been, claimed a more naturalist than classical ancestry, one legible in terms of energy and physicality. That immediately linked with modern imperatives. At a time when there was anxious debate about degeneration and the poor standards of public health, the Rubensian figure, full of strength and sap, typified exemplary vigour, and Baynard's and Rolle's painting was frequently admired as vital, healthy. Second, these artists show different ways of experimenting with naturalism in public art. With a subject such as the joys of life, Rolle essayed a new kind of painting, in which almost random elements coalesced in a free-form composition. Paradoxically, in such a decoration, apparent disdain for form created a new kind of form, where harmony was evoked by fluid elements such as colour masses, spatial voids, and scattered centres of interest. Baynard took painting even more demonstrably into the new scientific understanding of the universe in flux. If truth leading the scientists injected modernity into an allegory of the sciences by its cosmic setting, dynamic movement, and poster-like chromatics, life reborn from death took formal innovation further. Here, Baynard found an equivalent for science's new concept of the natural world as an unceasing continuum of organisms in flux, again in formal terms, by painting fluid shapes in chemical colours, using brushwork to convey energy. Both Rolle and Baynard took the opportunity in the mid-1890s to experiment, trying, perhaps not always successfully, to find ways of painting which corresponded with progressive thinking. If the dominant naturalism of the 1880s and 90s mapped comfortably onto mainstream republicanism's commitment to egalitarianism, accuracy and legibility, then the organicism with which Rolle and Baynard attempted to produce new work represented a further engagement between painting and progressive ideas. Can we go any further to explain this interplay between art and science? Was the interest in energy and flux manifested in the work of Rolle and Baynard just apparent in a few public decorations? Or was it to be found in other art, more private or avant-garde work? Indeed, how can we account for this new concept of the flux of time and matter and its transmission from the hermetic world of scientific research into mainstream consciousness? We can begin to answer some of these questions by tracing some points of contact and crossover. Rolle's Joys of Life and Baynard's Life Reborn from Death, completed in 1895 and 6 respectively, coincided with the emergence of a new movement within republicanism, Léon Bourgeois' solidarism. Bourgeois' book Solidarité was published in 1896. He argued that society protects us, but in return we have a duty to contribute to it. Humans are interdependent. We function not as individuals, but as cells within the larger social organism. Bourgeois' principles had various dimensions. One was republican, in that he was in essence applying the notion of fraternité. Another was loosely anti-clerical, as he was replacing the Christian notion of charity, which is voluntary, with the more scientific solidarity. Crucially, a third was scientific, because Bourgeois brought into play ideas from the natural sciences. He was influenced by the work of the chemist Marcellin Berthelot, and in particular by the zoologist Alfred Milne Edwards. He was called Alfred Milne Edwards, but he was French. his analyses of the way cells operate in mutual and dynamic support for the benefit of the organism which they collectively comprise. It's perhaps no surprise that Bourgeois was a close friend of Aurel. Thus, we have three elements in play: science's conception of nature's constant flux, solidarism's promotion of mutual social development, and the search for new painterly solutions to convey the continuum of interactive energies. All were progressive, aware of each other's initiatives, and had organicism as their central core. What I would like to suggest is that here we have naturalist painting, for Rolle's fleshy nudes and Baynard's decomposing woman are fundamentally descriptive, stretching to an extreme to match the ever-expanding knowledge of natural sciences and to sustain its alliance with progressive republicanism. Another point of contact was the crucial role of publications popularising science. This took off in the 1880s with the success of periodicals like La Nature and of writers such as Camille Flammarion and Gaston Tissandier, to say nothing of the novels of Jules Verne. The vogue for popular science suited the Republic's secular ideology, better to understand the world via science than God, and received the backing of leading lights such as Pasteur. The popularisation literature covered all aspects of science, giving the general public a broad understanding of the gradual processes of geological formation and the evolution of species, or the mysterious, mutating and invisible existence of microbes. Electricity was a particular popular fascination because it serves man's physical needs for light and heat, yet was an energy ubiquitous and unseen. Electrically lit fountains around the Eiffel Tower were one of the great attractions of the 1889 Exposition Universelle. There's a drawing of them by Camille Pissarro in the Ashmolean. And in November 1892, the American dancer Louis Fuller made her debut at the Folies Bergères with an act for which electric light was essential. Fuller stood still on stage, manipulating on long sticks great swathes of material. The combination of the movements she made with the material and the coloured light projected from below her through the glass plate on which she stood defined the dance. Sinuous and green-blue for the serpentine dance, flickering and red-orange for the fire dance. Fuller seduced artists and photographers, among them Toulouse-Lautrec, there with the two lithographs on the right, whose every impression of this lithograph, made in 1893, was printed in different colours to suggest the currents of rhythm and colour which characterised her performances. The novelist Paul Adon ironised how it was the coloured electrical lighting which enraptured businessmen and shopkeepers who would normally only be interested in dancers' busts and bums. When Louis Fuller performed, said Adon, she was no longer a woman, but a whirlwind or a nebula. Here, then, is an example of how popular entertainment culture drew on scientific advances, in turn stimulating metaphors which drew on scientific observation of constantly mutating natural forms. One final example of crossover. Gustave Eiffel's team of civil engineers, whose achievements during the 1880s numbered a series of pioneering new bridges and iron viaducts and culminated in the great tower built for the 1889 Exposition Universelle, included Maurice Koechlin. An Alsatian, Koechlin had studied at the Polytechnicum in Zurich, where he had learned the concept of biomimicry, developed by Hermann von Meyer, a professor of anatomy. This linked bone structures with the mathematics of load-bearing and came to interest Eiffel. Thus, it comes as no surprise to find in the Gallery of Comparative Anatomy at the Jardin des Plantes in Paris dinosaur bones which echo and may have inspired the splayed legs which evenly spread the weight of the Eiffel Tower. I'm on dangerous ground here and know nothing about civil engineering. But here is another, an utterly different example of the contemporary interplay between science and arts, in this case architecture, an interplay that recognised consistencies of form and function, that was implicitly metaphorical, that is again symptomatic of a mentalité with an instinct for interdisciplinarity. Let's return to art and widen the range. However inscrutable the processes of cross-fertilisation, the development of scientific ideas overlapped with forms of representation. This interplay can be traced in public as well as private art, and, appropriately enough, both on the macro and the micro scales. In 1898, Fernand Cornon completed a ceiling and 10 panels for the Musée d'Histoire Naturelle in Paris, tracing the evolution of humanity as far as the Iron Age. The ceiling, Humanité, conveyed that Darwinian sense of evolution by rising arcs of figures. To the left, the Aryan races led by beauty, and to the right, the Semitic races guided by faith. Cormor's formal decisions, monochrome rather than full colour, the upward spirals, movement from dark to light, linked style to the idea of evolution. By contrast, Odillon Redon's lithographic album Les Origines, published in 1883, was quite different in medium and scale, intended to be meditated in private, not seen in a public museum. But at its intimate level, it too uses formal means to convey evolutionary flux. On the frontispiece, none of these strange creatures has a resolved identity, while to the lower right, they're barely defined at all. Here, the process of delineation echoes the process of evolution. That sense of evolving takes on an even more ambiguous associative quality in Les bêtes de la mer rondes comme des outres, the creatures of the sea round as water flasks, from the third Tentation de Saint-Antoine series of 1896. Redon's forms here are like jellyfish or hooded figures, taking shape in the centre but trailing off at the lower edges, as if still in development, perhaps hatched from the spores behind. The images Redon gathered in his albums of lithographs were pioneering in the way they often ask the viewer to dwell on organic process. But by the 1890s, very different artists, making work for very different purposes, were becoming interested in picture making that, by allowing a more fluid play of form to evoke a sense of process, corresponded with the new awareness of the world in flux. Reading art, whose forms suggested process, rather than art whose images used established pictorial systems, troubled even sophisticated spectators. The curator Léonce Bénédict objected that Cormon's Humanité was incomprehensible because it rejected centuries of allegories and conventions for synthetic conceptions one has to decode like a rebus. But the way organicism allied form and meaning made for a new kind of art for a modern sensibility. Fluid, associative, energised. By the 1880s and 1890s, allegory was a struggle for artists required to find imagery for new subjects for which there were no conventions. Ernest Duez, there on the left, was in Bénard's team to decorate the Salon des Sciences in the Hôtel de Ville, commissioned to paint physics. His solution is splendidly ridiculous. A young woman, draped in satin, leaning on four tomes and speaking on the telephone. A hot air balloon drifts in the distance, and a flash of lightning in the corner apologetically alludes to electricity. Eugène Carrière painted the surrounding spandrels. Whoops, sorry. You can see one of the spandrels up there, but this is another one. Carrière's technique of thin monochrome washes from which the forms emerge integrated their shapes with the architecture, and the Rubensian pulse of the fleshy figure of medicine there on the right aptly alludes to health and vitality without the need for obtrusive accessories. Carrière's characteristic style had emerged in the late 1880s. During the second half of the decade, his work had shifted from the tenebrous naturalism of a painting like 1885's Sick Child on the left to canvases like The Yarn Winders of 1887, in which the figures are simultaneously unified by and subsumed into the muted ambient light which enwraps them. Carrière's mature style received public affirmation at his one-man show at the Busseau et Valadon Gallery in spring 1891, with pictures like these, and it was paintings like these by Carrière that inspired one of Degas' most masterful put-downs. "I see they've been smoking again in the nursery." In his catalogue preface, Gustave Geffroy's suggestive prose evoked Carrière's sense of the flux of life. "Emotions erupt, pass, lead and follow each other across mobile physiognomies," he wrote, in images about life mixed with the life of others. The radical critic Albert Aurier's response to the exhibition also acknowledged flux, but analysed it in terms of time as well as emotion, asking, "Is the immediate sensation worth counting when it's hardly had the time to occur before it tumbles into the gulf of memory?" Geoffroy and Aurier, followed by others, saw Carrière's fluid painting in terms of psychology, the inner life of individuals, and the interplay of emotion between them. Camille Mauclair, also writing in 1891, saw Besnard's work in similar fashion, when he argued that the constantly shifting light falling on his subjects meant constantly shifting emotional reactions within the painter, so that light and the continuum of natural energies was the incessant psychological stimulator of the artist. Such analyses, seeking to harmonise new painting with new scientific ideas, were shaping a modern frame of intellectual and cultural reference. If the world, in the microcosm and the macrocosm, was in constant flux, then the physical could not be separated from the psychological, or the past from the present. These various currents run together in an image produced appropriately enough right at the end of the period we're dealing with. In 1900, the sculptor Auguste Rodin asked his close friend Carrière to produce an image that could be used for the poster to promote his one-man show of work, which would take place during the Exposition Universelle. It was probably Rodin himself who suggested that he be represented at work. Simple as it may first seem, Carrière's lithograph is richly associative. Light falls on the sculptor's intent gaze and on his powerful hands, which rest on the base of the figure he is shaping. This is a moment when eye and mind consider the next move, and the hands await instruction, a moment in the process of creation. The sculpted figure is only generalised, not fully formed. Much of it remains in shadow, awaiting the sculptor's continued work to make it ready for the light. The sculptor's ability to create human form from inert matter, together with his wise, bearded presence, suggests a divine authority, and the play of light and shadow, only revealing a half-formed figure, suggests genesis. In such an image, form itself and the process of becoming form becomes a metaphor. Artists' adoption of fluid, organicist forms affected how works of art were understood. Here, symbolism, naturalism's rival aesthetic from the late 1880s, played an important part. The writers who dealt most empathetically with organicist images were usually those who were either symbolist writers themselves, and thus at home with the elusive and metaphoric, or those who are sympathetic to symbolism. A good example of this comes with Carrière's Théâtre Populaire, a picture that is at least that big. exhibited at the 1895 Salon de la Nationale, representing an audience at the local theatre in the proletarian quartier of Belleville. The painting encouraged many contemporary critics to discuss it in terms of the character of the Parisian working classes. Did it show them good-natured, enthused by culture, or did it thinly mask their potentially destructive instincts? But there were others who approached the painting differently. For the symbolist poet and novelist Georges Rodenbach, the very large composition Théâtre Populaire literally flowed from the small landscape studies that Carrière painted in Brittany. Landscapes like this, not that one though. Here are those Finistère marines, enthused Rodenbach, transposed to paint the eddying masses at the theatre. Isn't a crowd just a sea swell? Carrière has painted a crowd returned to nature, become, so to speak, an element, and which surges with the drama like the sea beneath the moon. Rodenbach was obviously well informed about Carrière's creative practice, not only his pictorial linkage of landscape and figurative forms, but also his conceptual equivalence of the natural and the human. I want to close by looking briefly at the tensions between the organic and the descriptive. With Carrière's Théâtre Populaire at the 1895 Salon de la Nationale hung L'Ermite's Les Halles. This is a huge painting which is now rolled up, hence the black and white image. A picture conventionally naturalistic in its depiction of traders and shoppers at the Paris Central Market. Geoffroy found this huge canvas frustrating. The artist was too concerned to document. He forgot that in a crowd you can only look at one element at a time. A crowd is not an accumulation of detail, but une onde, a wave of movement. For Geoffroy, L'Ermite's naturalism not only failed to be naturalistic, it also neglected the new perceptual and psychological understanding of the flux of experience. For both Geoffroy and Rodenbach had come to favour painting which was not descriptive and documentary, but rather organic and metaphoric. If Rodenbach and Geoffroy shared an oceanic metaphor in accounting for those crowd pictures in 1895, Geoffroy had earlier used an animal one in his account of one of Monet's paintings of Belle-Île off the Brittany coast. In 1887, Geoffroy described rocks at Port Guelphar, painted the previous year, as hairless hillocks, yellowed and reddened by autumnal vegetation, rounded and thick, like clumsily shaped creatures, pachyderms with thick crusts. This is a surprising reading. We'd expect Monet's rocks at Port Guelphar to be seen as an example of impressionist naturalism, painted sur le motif, true to local colour, responsive to specific atmospheric conditions. But Geoffroy chose to read it metaphorically and organically, eliding natural landscape with bestial forms. Albert Aurier did the same when he wrote about Van Gogh's work in January 1890. Although he did not describe a specific canvas, it is difficult not to think of Starry Night when one reads Aurier's prose. There are cypresses shooting up their nightmarish silhouettes of blackened flames, mountains arching their backs like mammoths or rhinoceroses. It was easier for Aurier to write about Van Gogh's work in such a way because some of Vincent's recent canvases were so evidently quite distant from the descriptive, certainly further so than Monet's work. But using metaphor, as these critics did, was a means of responding to painting which allied the critic with the artist, setting both against descriptive naturalism, which logically required critical response in descriptive prose. Metaphor allowed the writer a supple, suggestive means of writing about new painterly idioms, which themselves sprang from artists' own changing intuitions about the external world. But critics could be no more consistent in their responses to paintings than artists were in making them. we should not expect absolute consistency in artists any more than we should demand of painters a lucid theoretical account. But the inconsistencies can be eloquent. Look at Monet's work in the Creuse Valley in the Massif Central in 1889. A painting looking down into a rushing mountain stream can be read as a triumph of impressionist naturalism, the play of paint approximating so closely to the immediate experience of vision. And yet, that instant is part of a constant, as the stream flows on and on past the watching artist. This sense of time is doubly apparent in canvases of sunset over the Creuse Gorge. The sunset marks a moment in the short durée of the day, but the ravine itself, cut by the flowing river, embodies the infinitely longer durée of geological time. Such canvases inherently deal with time and flux, but Monet's letters, written as he made them, give no indication that such thoughts were on his mind. However, critics more habituated to articulating the wider intellectual culture could make such connections. In his preface for the exhibition of grainstack paintings that Monet staged in Paris in May 1891, Geoffroy praised Monet's ability to seize the ephemeral instant which has just happened, which dies and will never return, as well as what is ceaseless, the course of the earth through space. This is very similar to the language Geoffroy would use a year later when he talked about Baynard's Truth Leading the Sciences as suggesting both the infinitely large and the infinitely small. In both cases, the intellectual making connections between contemporary science and art, which the painter could only intuit. But painters did have a sense of larger patterns, struggled with on their canvases. In 1889, the year Monet worked in the Creuse, Van Gogh was painting 250 miles away in Saint-Rémy. Vincent was considerably more articulate in his letters than Monet. Much of his correspondence concerns the tension in his work between paintings made from nature, his preferred method, and done from the imagination, which he found difficult. This dilemma is often taken to be a struggle between habitual practice and personal expression, style, the subject of my next lecture. That was indeed a central issue, but does it make enough of the differences between paintings such as Starry Night and this olive grove? One is still fundamentally descriptive, concerned to recreate the earth tones and textures of the trees in paint. The other is, in my meaning of the term, organicist, adapting style to become metaphorically analogous to the infinitude and indivisibility of time and nature. It would be quite wrong to attribute to Van Gogh the ambition to realise a new kind of painting which tried to harmonise art and new understandings of science. That was Baynard's aim when he was specifically commissioned to decorate buildings where experimental science was taught. But Van Gogh, like Monet, intuited this interplay, and an astute critic like Geoffroy could grasp it. Intuition is the crucial word here, I think. This lecture has taken a meandering path through some very varied and perhaps surprising territory. Baynard and Roll are artists little rated today, and probably you wouldn't expect to find their work considered alongside Monet's or Van Gogh's. I've tried not to insist upon a single narrative, when there isn't one. Neither would I try to claim that what I've called organicism qualifies as a style with certain consistent characteristics. But in the later 1880s and 1890s, there were intuitions or mentalités which caused artists to think and work, and critics and public to write and respond differently. These included the growing understanding that the material world in both macrocosm and microcosm was in constant flux, and so too was our psychological experience of that world in terms of perception and memory. Linked to this was the recognition that it was science in its varied forms which generated this changing understanding, and that in order to be modern, art needed to keep pace with science. These pressures began to encourage some artists to rethink their relation to the naturalist aesthetic, which itself was rooted in a scientific ethos, that of positivist determinism. Rolle and Baynard, as we've seen, adapted from the conventional naturalism of the 14th of July and the chemistry course to the chaos of energies of the joys of life and life reborn from death. These were artists undertaking public commissions, promoting the Republic's energetic commitment to modernity and science. Significantly, they were prepared to adapt their styles to address developing scientific ideas, ideas that influenced politics itself, as in the case of solidarism. Baynard and Carrière were particularly aware of the need to generate new pictorial idioms which gave visual correspondence to the organicism that by the 1890s was the most sophisticated way of understanding the world. Independent artists, making work for private consumption, had similar intuitions. Monet and Van Gogh might have continued to work largely from nature, but their work became increasingly, if not always consistently, concerned to articulate responses to the visible world that were mobile. Quite independently, they used personal style, the pattern of brushworks, the exaggeration of rhythm, the harmonisation of colour, to create paintings the handling of which did not depict, but echoed the energies of flux of nature. Paintings that caused observers to discuss them either with scientific analogies or with metaphors which evoked the cross-referential comprehension of things which was so modern. If we have a sense of these intuitions, then I think we can see that Van Gogh's Starry Night and Baynard's Truth Leading the Sciences have a degree of overlap. It is certainly not stylistic. The organicism which I've been adumbrating found varied forms, only loosely consistent in their fluid contours and pulsing shapes. But such paintings shared an unspoken aesthetic, striving to create a new painting, articulating modernity, but no longer describing modern life, sensitive to scientific progress and deeply responsive to the vast energies and eternally interactive rhythms of nature. Thank you.